Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 20th of October 2018. This is episode 3. I've just come through a bit of a, I'm still going through a nightmare where some of the fundamental submodules are not functioning correctly, and the kids have been on my computer playing old discs from 15 years ago or something like that, some of them. And so I'm just doing a full virus scan to get all that and probably reinstalling some software. So it's a big, big effort after a tumultuous night where I've made, or weekend where I've made some really good solid progress. Now this one is interesting. It's the solutes crash leaves the ISS in a grim spot. So solutes is the Russian space capsule from the 60s, in actual fact. It's, it has undergone upgrades, but it's the same basic technology has been kept through, going through. And the ISS is the big US International All-Singing and Dancing Space Station with modern technology on it. And this is by Leah Crane. The near future of human space flight is looking dangerously uncertain. On October 11th, a Russian Soyuz craft carrying two astronauts to the International Space Station had an issue with one of its boosters, causing a crash landing about 400 kilometers from the launch site in Kazakhstan. Fortunately, the astronauts are alive and well, but the failed flight may complicate things for the ISS. Astronaut Nikki Haig and Russian cosmonaut Alexei Oshovin are in good condition, but after the bumpy ride, including forces of 6 to 7 times the gravity on Earth's surface, it could easily have gone the other way. The average person might pass out under a force of 5G. The malfunction is particularly troubling because the Soyuz rocket and the capsule are the only spacecraft currently capable of carrying humans to the ISS. All crewed solids launchers are suspended until NASA and the Russian space agency Roscosmos figure out what happened and how to prevent it in future. That means no one now can reach the station. The accident's coming on the heels of an air leak that was in the last crewed Soyuz visit to visit the ISS may mark a point of reckoning for human spaceflight. The damaged Soyuz, which could currently be which is currently docked on the ISS, is the only way the three astronauts on board can return to Earth. The hull has since been repaired and is in part of the spacecraft that isn't important for re-entry to the Earth's atmosphere. Even so, the docked Soyuz will reach the end of its official safe lifespan in early January. Past then, Roscosmos will have to send empty Soyuz to get the crew back to Earth. That puts three astronauts in a tough place. They can come home abandoning the station, or they can extend their mission until the Soyuz or another craft is ready to send a crew of astronauts to replace them. Supplies will not be a problem because there are several other uncrewed spacecraft that can bring food and fuel to the whatever it is, the spacecraft, the space station. Now, there is a particularly interesting picture. There's a picture of an outside, a hand, human hand, waving inside this little space dome. The possibility that the Soyuz craft will be grounded, there is a possibility that the Soyuz craft will be grounded for a long time. NASA is notoriously careful when it comes to astronaut lives, and the agency may not wait for the Soyuz get to three strikes. But then, NASA retired the space shuttle in 2011 with plans to quickly replace the capsules made by SpaceX and Boeing. Delays and budget cuts mean the new spacecraft now won't be ready until mid-2019. At the earliest, stringent NASA attitudes about risk and testing make it unlikely these flights will be accelerated, even in an emergency. China is now the only country with a working spacecraft capable of taking humans into space. But It has only ever launched 6 missions and is currently excluded from the International Space Station program. Theoretically, the Shenzhou craft, which is based on Soyuz design, could dock in the ISS, but such a mission would require an extraordinary act of geopolitical negotiation and technical ability. If the astronauts do come home without being replaced by the new crew, the ISS will be empty for the first time since 2000. If it remains empty, the lack of upkeep could doom the already aging station, taking down the world's most valuable and important asset in space, which is the only asset in space, I think. For want of a proverbial nail, humanity's exploration of the universe could be set back for decades. Well, I think that might be a bit of a extension. Now, I'll skip the photograph section and go on to this article about the fashion for fasting cover story. Fasting diets seem here to stay, and the evidence are that they're good for you is stacking up. Carolyn Williams tries one herself. This picture of this rather glamorous woman, alone looking at a rather dejected carrot on a plate, and scientists see the side of her. Next to it is don't eat it all at once. Okay, as I unpack my rations for the next 5 days, I start to question what I've signed up to. For years I've heard about the hype of fasting diets and what they promise. Smaller thighs, a clearer head, a lower risk of cancer, heart disease and diabetes, and a promise of generally longer, healthier life. But then there's the hunger. Hunger makes me angry and tired and generally not a very nice person. So I've always given fasting diets a miss. The 5:2 diet, where you fast for 2 days a week and eat normally for the others. The 16:8, where you eat within 8-hour window and fast for 16. The alternate day fasting, you know it, it seems someone has tried it. I've heard about one of the latest trends, the fasting mimicking diet. If marketing materials are to be believed, it is the holy grail. All the health benefits of fasting without the hunger. The company behind it has even become the first to be granted a patent for boosting human lifespan before the onset of disease. So, can I really have... That sounds ridiculous. Can I really have my cake and eat it? Or not eat it, is okay? She says not eat it, but I decided to give it a go and try to get the truth about fasting. We've known for decades that restricting calories can have the beneficial effects, if not in humans, then in animals. Many studies have found that organisms from single-celled yeasts to rodents age more slowly and live longer when their calorie intake falls to 40% of the consumed by a group of animals eating normally. Well, you'd hope by individuals. Now, that's a bit strange. Consumed by a group of animals, well, you really want... If it's more than 2 animals, you're overmuch. Constant calorie restriction has never really caught on in people, however, not least because the results don't bear out in primates. Again, that's a bizarre sentence. Besides, people find it difficult to restrict their diet in a way for long enough to find out if it extends their lives. Fasting has been part of the religious practice around the world for millennia. But it first made it into the consumer mainstream about 5 years ago on the back of animal studies of research in overweight people suggesting that skipping meals could have numerous health benefits. There is growing evidence that periodically going without food puts our body into a kind of emergency mode, where they conserve energy, make repairs, and prioritize mental activities to solve a problem finding food. Yeah, there's that, if you don't have enough protein, you start eating yourself, and it takes a long while to recover. If we accept that the Paleolithic was an environment in which most modern humans' adaptations were shaped, which I think is bizarre, including dietary ones, the hunter-gatherers then were adapted to periods of feast and famine, says Stanley Ujazek, a nutrition anthropologist at the University of Oxford. This will be more than a natural state for us than the 3 meals a day. As well as weight loss, proponents claim that intermittent fasting could help protect against cancer, diabetes, or disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. My own enthusiasm at the promise of hunger-free fast diminishes somewhat as the kit arrives. It would be, I would be living off 2 packets of soup a day, plus a few crackers, olives, and the odd nut bar. It looked a lot like hunger to me. The particular diet is the brainchild of Walter Longo, a gerontologist at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. The basic claim is that the fasting just once a month, albeit for 5 days, can mimic the effects seen in fasting animals, even reversing the effects of aging. Websites on Longo's spin-off company, Prolong, says that fasting mimic diet is clinically proven to induce the body's protectionist and rejuvenation mode while providing enough calories that you don't actually pass out. Anyone can benefit from this cellular spring clean, says Longo. Quote, it doesn't matter how good your gut diet is, it doesn't matter how much exercise you do, the body ages and cells accumulate damage. Thanks to animal studies, we know a fair amount about what happens to the body when the food is scarce. A lack of nutrients kick-starts a process called autophagy, which is eating yourself, which the cells break down and damaged or dysfunctional parts are recycled and used as fuel. Yeah, I suppose that makes sense. If you're going to, you know, it'll get rid of the worst, the least parts of fuel. The thinking is that this system probably evolved to maximize the chances of surviving famine. That's where you eat yourself. Autophagy happens at low level in healthy cells, but becomes less efficient as we age. Sluggish autophagy lets the inside of cells gunk up and has been linked to many age-related diseases, including cancer, and to the aging process itself. Some researchers believe that the price of health problems like cancer and type 2 diabetes has a lot to do with the rise, with the fact that many people no longer go hungry. Although the initial findings came from research in mice, last year Longo and his colleagues published a study of around 100 people. But he's running a bloody company, you know, gosh. Who either did the fasting mimicking diet for 5 days a month over 3 months or continued with their normal diet for 3 months. The second group then tried the fasting diet. When the people did the diet, they dropped in body weight and fat and ended up. Gee, that's 100 people, two groups, that's 50 people, that's really... Lower blood pressure, lower levels of hormone insulated like growth factor, IGF-1, which is thought to play a role in aging and disease. They also had lower levels of inflammation markers such as and cholesterol, among other benefits. For my little experiments, before I started the diet, I underwent some body tests measuring the level of IGF-1, cholesterol, C-reactive protein, a marker of inflammation. Also had body composition scan and a measure of any effects to my body fat at the Oxford Centre for Diabetes, Endocrinology and Metabolism. That would be a fantastic centre. Frederick Karp, who runs the centre, is sceptical to say the least. It's very important to critically investigate health claims for interventions giving great promises, he says. You like how he's tucked away, so the claim gets up there. She's in it. You're hooked to the diagram. One critical question is how long you need to fast to kickstart the process. After all, we know famines are seriously bad for our health. Unfortunately, the answer is unclear. In a recent review of health effects of fasting, Benjamin Horn of the Intermountain Heart Institute in Salt Lake City, Intermountain, Utah, concluded that no research had yet identified a set line between fasting and starvation. And it probably varies a lot depending on the body you have to start with. I could well imagine if you're already dead. Another effect of fasting is that the body starts to run out of glucose in the blood and glucogen stores in the liver, which causes the metabolic switch. The liver starts converting fats to ketones, into ketone bodies that the muscles brain uses fuels. But the process, this is a process called ketosis. This is why fasting almost always causes weight loss of somewhere between 2.5 and 8%. But how long you need to fast before you switch to ketosis occurs unknown. Longo says it takes at least 3 days, And that shorter fast, such as the 5-2 diet, don't last long enough to make it happen. Mark Matten of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, who studies the effects of fasting on the brain, disagrees. The liver holds about 700 calories worth of glycogen, and people with just general activities around the house burn maybe 50 calories in an hour. So if you're not eating during that time, you do the maths, and it's around 10 hours. Well, that's hard to argue. It would make sense. That's why you have fat. Add exercise to... Oh, shit. Sorry for the interruption. A actual marsh fly landed on me. You know, it's the beginning of summer when you get these things. They actually only bite. They're around the place. They only bite for, I don't know, a week or so, a few weeks in late summer. So, they bumble along, and they're just, when they land on you and bite, they're easy to kill. You know, like, I don't think one's ever really survived, but there was one just flying around. I had to stop, and I was still trying to look to rebuild my software. Okay, but getting back to this question, someone saying fast, and this person saying it's all loopy-loop science, and it's sort of really... I suppose it's like real life trying to get through issues. Add exercise to the equation, which can happen even faster, says Morrison. Because it can burn 100 calories in 10 minutes. Get your sports shoes on for a few hours after your last meal, and you won't take long to hit ketosis, he says, leaving me wondering why I'm sticking out a 5-day fast instead. Surely they can actually measure that in, you don't have to do the maths, you can actually measure it. Another claim about fasting that almost tempted me in the past was the cognitive effect. Fasters regularly boast about clearer thinking and improved focus. Jakeski observed something similar with modern-day hunter-gatherers. While foraging with Wokemi in Papua New Guinea in the 80s, he noticed that they never started the day with breakfast because they preferred to be hungry while hunting. They said it's usually made them lighter on your feet and more aware of the surroundings, said Jessica. Well, there you go. So far, though, no controlled studies have been done to investigate the link between fasting cognition in humans, and the only hints about what might be going on come from mice. Oh, surely that would be something easy to study, do cognitive tests at different times of the day. I just don't, I really don't, you know, with cups of coffee, sugar, we drink. So they've had to look at mice instead. Masson's group found that switching to ketosis gives the brain a boost, stimulating the release of a chemical BDFM. There was chemicals that I wanted to study. It's gone from my head. Which promotes new connections between neurons and stimulates neurons to make mitochondria, which generate energy. I'm just really concerned about how... I mean, I could well imagine that goes up. You can make more mitochondria as you need. This could be done, could be the ticket for mental clarity reported by fasters. His team is conducting a randomized study in human volunteers to find out whether the brain changes are associated with effects seen in people, with results expected in early 2019. Mental clarity certainly wasn't something I experienced. My brain hit the wall early on day two, and on most days during the fast, I gave up trying to work and went back to bed. After day three, my legs ached like I had the flu, apparently a sign of ketosis. Shock results. It was difficult to believe that something that made me feel so awful could possibly be doing me good, especially since my tests from before the fast showed that I was already metabolically healthy. I had low levels of bad cholesterol, heavy, healthy blood sugar, fat levels, and very low amounts of visceral fat, the stuff that sticks to our organs, which can be a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and diabetes. The body scans show a fair amount of this fat, 30%, but nearly all concentrated on my hips. Actually, I must be a girl. And thighs, a pattern that has been linked to a lower risk of heart disease and diabetes. After 5 days of fasting, none of this had shifted. The body's composition scan revealed that I had lost over 1 kilogram in weight, 584 grams of which came from the loss of lean mass, and only 168 grams from body fat. This is a bit of a shock. One selling point of the fasting mimicking diet is it's supposed to target visceral fat, protecting the lean mass. According to Longo, ketosis doesn't target the visible body wobbly bits, only fat around the organs. As I started off with little visceral fat, I had indeed targeted my lean mass, he says. Gosh. Wow, what a jerk. Quote, from a global health perspective, I find it quite a negative outcome, says Karp. Find half of your change was muscle. The fat regions have not changed much at all. And that's not what you intended. Could it be that lean mass loss was the result of arthropathy? Mice put on the Longo's diet in the middle age certainly seem to have some kind of clear cut. Their livers, heart, and kidneys all shrank during the fast, and they had a temporary cull in the number of some kinds of blood cells. All went back to normal within a few days of normal eating, heralded by an increase of markers of liver regeneration and tentative signs of muscle regeneration. The assumption is that the decrepit cells that were removed were replaced by newer, shinier versions. The evidence of arthropathy, which is what he's actually saying, but gosh. It's just whether it's ethical, because I don't think consumers can actually understand the message. The evidence of arthropathy and regeneration in human trials, however, is purely circumstantial. And we don't know whether new cells are healthier than the ones lost. Longo concedes that this is something this team is still working on. When it came to, they all obviously, yeah, oh, here's the result. Oh, we're out of a job. No, I don't think so. When it came to blood markers of health and longevity, my results were similarly unimpressive. The only marked difference was in the hormone IGF, which is again, yes, one person. It's not scientific studies, as far as I'm concerned. If prolonged trials volunteers saw a significant reduction in IGF-1, which Longo says is still there 3 months after going back on a normal diet, whether this adds up to increased longevity, however, is less clear. Epidemiological studies have linked both low and high IGF studies to early death, with high IGF levels linked to increased cancer risk and low to cardiovascular disease. Pick your choice. Of course, my experiment isn't very scientific. And if I did get me wondering, for those of us who are healthy to begin with, does fasting truly offer benefits beyond the fact that you inevitably cut a few calories and lose a bit of weight? Michelle Harvey, researcher from Manchester University, UK, came up with the 5-2 diet, told me that, based on current research, we just don't know. Intermittent dieting is proven a method of weight loss. We don't know the benefits or harms of healthy weight or underweight people, she says. A serving of truth. Maybe the original studies of fasting diets involved overweight volunteers. Even Longo studies of 100 healthy volunteers, 2/3 started on BMI over 25, making the vast majority overweight or obese. So, while the health markers such as body mass index, visceral fats and blood pressures were all significantly reduced after doing it fast 3 times over 3 months, it isn't clear whether this can be explained by the simple fact that they're losing weight. Fasting also tends to mean eating a lot less animal protein and fat, and have been linked to cancer, so this might be responsible for the side effects of the trial, the effects of the trial. When a person is a healthy weight, their body clear-out functions work fine on their own, says Karp. Any normal physiological system in a healthy, lean human being, eating well, exercising, doing what he likes to do, all these things work, and that's why healthy people who exercise and eat normal things live longer than overweight people. Susan Jebb, a nutrition scientist at the University of Oxford, agrees, I'm not aware of any high-quality evidence relating to intermittent fasting among people who are not overweight. Time will tell whether humans benefit from fasting beyond weight loss, so I can't help thinking that the wording printed on the box of Prolong that Longo sent me, which promises rejuvenation from within, is premature. We aren't yet sure that the body clears out damaged cells and replaces them with something better. For my own money, with the knowledge of the most body fat is stored away in my organs and blood results are entirely within range, I think I'll stick to my normal diet and take my chances. Yes, my body could probably handle less wine and chocolate, but going hangry in return for a payoff that may never materialize. Life is too short. Do you like it? Life is too short to lengthen your life. Beautiful. Let's just save something witty to the end. Next article. Full steam ahead. Recent advances could have cracked the immense promise of geothermal heat to power our world, Julia Rosen reports. I don't know whether this article or just the geothermal energy is that we have a large nuclear reactor of uranium melting down in the center of our Earth, creating a core which is around 5,000 degrees Celsius. the metal solid core, and that heat slowly goes up. So if we're lucky, we can get 1,000 degrees. You know, if we drill down, we can get water and steam up to 1,000 degrees. There's a whole lot of problems there. That is, you extract the energy and you cool down the area. So you've got to be able to connect a large area and reliably go. So most things, you can get geothermal energy. It's just to get a large, continuous amount of heat out of it. It's the thing to do, because you are essentially trying to get heat out of a very good insulator. Rock is a fantastic insulator. I suppose you can frack and all these type of things. Okay. The Rjans Peninsula juts out, from the southwestern tip of Iceland like a hitchhiker's thumb. Most visitors glimpse it from a plane as they sweep down the runway to Keflavik Airport, or through the mist of at the Blue Lagoon, a hot, popular hot spring. Its otherworldly landscape is rumbled volcanic rocks and stout cinder cones. The most common sounds of life, tenacious mosses in varying shades and greens, and the odd wandering sheep. I suppose that the sheep must therefore eat moss. Tectonic seams that run along the bottom of the Atlantic. Seams. Belching out a new ocean cross between North America and Europe. Runs aground. That sentence is really complex. Let's let me read that one again. Here, the tectonic seam that runs aground. So, it's a seam and it actually reaches sea level. That's what she meant. That's what makes this place so attractive to people like Gordimannur or Olaf Fridlsfossum, chief geologist of the Icelandic company HS Orca. So it's good. That's a nice company. Just a few kilometres beneath their feet, the staggering heat of the volcano bubbles away. All they have to do is harness it. Its power is drill. Okay. Iceland already has plenty of geothermal energy, but the project is different. Fridtjof Fossum and his team are trapping into temperatures and pressures higher than anything else we've used before. So this will be the new ultra hot spots. So the problem is that if you go for really hot spots, you've got new engineering problems. What they are doing could help revolutionise geothermal energy and boost this outlook source for renewable power to a prominent place on the global energy system. It's a potential to unlock unprecedented amounts of energy. and make it accessible places far from volcanic fields in Iceland. It could make a dream of abundant geothermal energy reality. There's the heat. It's also, thermoelectric devices, you know, like how much energy you could get out of that one. So far, geothermal energy hasn't taken off like other renewables. What's actually not renewable? More than a century after humans started the Earth's hot water and steam to produce power, geothermal provides less than 1% of the world's electricity. There's no problem with supply. The depths of our planets still smolder from the violent accretion and slow burn of radioactive decay. I think the violent accretion is gone. The core is a searing 6,000 degrees Celsius. Well, I say it's 5,000, whatever it is. The heat is concentrated in the upper 3 kilometers of the crust, and the heat crust could be enough to meet the world's energy demands thousand times over. Geothermal energy also sidesteps the problem that plague many other sources of energy. It's always available, regardless of whether the wind blows or the sun shines. Alongside nuclear and hydropower, which have issues of their own, geothermal offers an attractive source of clean, reliable, base-load electricity. But as the high startup costs has historically been restricted to Iceland and other hotspots, with the challenge now is to increase the power and availability of geothermal energy so it can be truly compete. Well, I have this question here. It's just that you don't get these nice peachy hotspots. So there are a few sites in Australia, and remarkably, I don't remember what the reports were, but yeah, okay. The world's first geothermal power generator was Italian, built in the Verdant, which means green rolling hills of Tuscany, in 1904. The seething sulfurous hot springs as Laredo attracted Roman visitors millennia ago, and the Devil's Valley, as sometimes called, supposedly shaped Dante's vision of hell. But others saw something else in his steam, untamed energy. Today, 800 megawatts of power flow from the field supplying 10,000 residential homes, which is like a suburb or two. Not a huge amount of energy, 800 megawatts. It's a fair amount. Yeah, from 1904, it's pretty amazing. Yet humans are still scratching the surface. Conventional technologies can only exploit geothermal energies in spots like Lando, where the heat-up water runs through natural plumbing systems easily accessible from the surface. But the Geothermal Energy Association, a U.S. trade group, estimates that the countries have developed just 7% of the world's hydrothermal potential. I wonder what that means. Does that mean that of 7% of the easily available, or 7% of things with you use a bit of technology? Digging deeper. Over the past few decades, however, researchers have been exploring ways to extract even more heat, including in regions not blessed with ideal geology. This needs a new approach, known as enhanced or engineered geothermal systems. Okay, that's where you actually do it, EGS. Can mean adding fluid to dry rocks to transport. That's where you get in. I think everyone has to do that nowadays. Heating it up along the way. It's called what nature gives you, and figuring out how to make it work, says Jeff Tester. Do you like Jeff Tester? A geothermal expert in Cornell University in New York. EGS could crack open massive stores of geothermal heat. In 2006, a report by Tester found, so he's 12 years, that the US alone, the technology can unlock 130 times as much energy as the country uses each year. Realistically, we always need sources of energy. We are likely to export just a fraction of geothermal's potential. Otherwise, it'll blow everyone to pieces. Oh, Why did everything blow up? Oh, I plugged my too much power into my washing machine. Long of the U.S. Department of Energy, EGS has another important advantage. It will make geothermal energy available outside existing hydrothermal systems. It's feasible everywhere, she says. The basic elements of EGS were first tested in experimental sites in New Mexico in the 1970s. Since those early days, we have made leaps and bounds, says Boyd. We know more about what's going on underground, and we have better drilling technology, some borrowed from advances in the oil and gas industry. I think the thing with the oil and gas injury, if you're gas, you just typically don't get, you can't steamy gas, so you don't get oil and gas. If you've got the oils up to 1,000 degrees, I just wonder what's happening, because the oil breaks down at 1,000 degrees or something like that, so I mean, it's underneath there, but you just don't wonder whether the oil and gas actually sticks together. So my point is that oil and gas is drilling in different areas, all very deep, but it's not necessarily very hot rock. Even so, engineers still face significant hurdles, says Boyd, with only a handful of commercial EGS sites operate today. For one thing, creating fractures in controlled, predictable ways remains a practical challenge, says Guy Falcone, an engineer at the University of Glasgow, UK. Sometimes the cracks close up again under the immense pressure and the overlying rock. Other times the rock cracks too much and the water flows too fast to heat up, she says. EGS can also have more serious consequences. In 2006, a commercial project in Basel, Switzerland, triggered earthquakes of 3.4 and rattled the city. Well, 3.4 is not that big. No one was hurt, but it made the residents nervous. They knew of magnitude 6, which is 1,000 times stronger, roughly. This is 10 times for each unit, so that's 10 to the 3.4, about 500 times stronger. Okay. This is the earthquake system. This, I really wish they'd do it. Hit the city in the Middle Ages. They knew. Did they? Oh, did you hear? Rumble? Oh, blood oath. Yeah, can you? Oh, whoa. Back in there. Got this bit of parchment. No idea. Okay. I can imagine. It's fun that hard to compute. It isn't the only case either. In 2007, an EGS project in Pohang, South Korea, is a likely source of a 5.5 and that earthquake that caused $52 million worth of damage. Both projects were eventually shuttered. Well, I don't know. There is no doubt that EGS, like mining, fracking for oil and gas, and disposing of wastewater can cause earthquakes, says Corin Lehan Brackman, engineer of Lawrence Berkeley Natural California Laboratory in California, who studied the Basel case. However, Lehan Brackman says the risk of serious quakes from geothermal production is low. She thinks incidents like Basel and Pohang can be avoided if developers choose EGS sites wisely and reduce the injection rates if tremors begin. But perhaps the biggest barrier to the approach has been economics. Since Tesla's report came out, the price of solar and wind energy has dropped. The cheap natural gas has flooded the market, making it hard for geothermal to expand, says Trenton Kalibox of Altrock Energy, a Seattle-based geothermal developer. I've been working on EGS for 10 years, he says. The market for geothermal has just been flat, which is interesting because that's when the reports came out. So Altrock and others have focused on their efforts on supercharged version of the geothermal instead. The ideas are pursuing has its root in a series of accidents in the 80s when geothermal engineers unexpectedly encountered a super hot conditions. The first instance happened at Laredo. Is Laredo the Tuscany bit? Where's Laredo? Oh yeah, it is. It is the Tuscany thing. So why are they drilling in there? Okay. A well struck 380 degrees Celsius water just shy of 4 kilometers down, of course. The drillers were totally unprepared for the heat, as were the materials they used to make the well. They abandoned and came clear the casing wouldn't hold. Another hole drilled nearby a few years later hit the same reservoir and blew a massive explosion of steam in 1888. Sorry, 1988. Something similar happened in Iceland. But Friðriksson, who had recently completed his PhD, another Icelandic volcano, was surprised by his find on another Icelandic volcano. Well, on the subject of it, his PhD wasn't. He didn't go to the volcano to complete his PhD. If researchers could figure out how to manage these fluids, they could capitalize on the bonanza. That is because above 374 degrees Celsius annular pressure and 122 bars of pressure, water transforms into supercritical fluid. At this temperature, the pressure rises, says Frithjofsson, water gets lighter and steam gets heavier until they become one phase. It's a totally different beast. Supercritical water at 400 degrees contains 5 times the amount of energy as water at 200 degrees in a typical geothermal well. It also transfers energy twice as efficiently and has a lower viscosity, flowing out of the ground more easily. Gee, can you imagine that? You've got high viscosity, change of viscosity, you could really get yourself up with an explosion. That it's going out, and then it gets pressures through a certain amount, and then gums up. It's a thing to really put. I just wonder whether that sort of thing, that viscosity, you need a basic sort of negative resistance for a system to oscillate. Old Faithful in Yosemite, where the actual basis of that is a phase negative viscosity coefficient. To get an oscillating system, you have to have a negative system where it has to hunt around it. This is for all unstable oscillators or anything like that. In 2003, Frithjof and Wilfred Elders, now an emeritus professor at the University of California, Riverside, who together led the geothermal project at Rockefeller, calculated a well-producing supercritical fluid could generate 10 times more energy than a conventional one. Oh dear, and they've got 5 megawatts versus 50 megawatts. Oh there. Guess he couldn't do the calculation in his head. So this is down here, they've got a diagram. Caldas says that could make the economics of geothermal work out for companies like his. It costs more to drill supercritical depths, but the increased energy production should be more than compensates, he says. EGS is really difficult to do, so you might as well do it in an area where you know the economics are going to be helpful. Okay. No one has been able to demonstrate the increased payout of supercritical geothermal so far, but Iceland, they're getting close. In 2009, Frithjof and Elders' team reached supercritical conditions, and then when it accidentally drilled into a magma chamber at the Kafr volcano, just for 2 years, a well produced a jet of superheated steam, but then a valve failed and it had to be sealed. You can well imagine that type of thing happening. In Icelandic group, then began to drill at Reykjanes, where they drilled a well 4.6 kilometers down to access the fluids at as hot as 600 degrees Celsius. For the past years, engineers have been pouring cold water down the well, which cracks in the rock, and sometimes used in EGS to increase the reservoir's permeability. Now the team is just waiting for the well to heat up again before they start testing it. Meanwhile, a new supercritical well has been completed at Laredo, which is the original one. The first time we met supercritical conditions by chance, says Sandra Scardi, and at Enel Green Power, which runs the Lando site. Now, this time, she says, it was intentional. And there's also supercritical projects funded in Japan, Mexico, and New Zealand, and Alt-Rock is looking for funding to deepen the existing well at Newbury Volcano in Oregon. The rest of the world is catching up, says Volcom. The only difference between us and them is that Iceland is in the lead. Oh dear. Like Righteous, these projects will probably use EGS and share the same risks and challenges, plus others associated with working with extreme conditions. Drill bits basically just start to form and melt, says Carl Holdus. You can imagine that the water is very difficult. I mean, there's often a lot of water with drilling, but it's, you know, this is one of the things, the oil comes up, but it's not hot. You know, it's actually almost, like it's not, it's actually quite cold. You know, when people get oil on them, it's not burning oil. And those are big things. Standard casing materials aren't designed for such high temperatures or for the clothes that bubble up from the depths. These eat away at the valves and cement coatings which expand and contract in the changing temperatures, risking blowouts. My godfather would. Finally, the standard electronics used to measure conditions in the well gets fried. You need optical fibers down there. The equipment is usually made for the oil and gas industry, says Engels, and it was never designed to handle such intense heat. There are geological uncertainties too, says Thomas Rhodes, engineer of Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. Tools usually used to probe the Earth's depths, like tracking how seismic waves move through the crust, have not been calibrated for rocks of extreme temperatures and pressures because it's hard to recreate such conditions in the lab. This means the results can be hard to interpret. Quote, we don't know what kind of geology is down there, says Reichert. We're drilling basically into the dark. All in all, developing supercritical geothermal is a monumental challenge, but Friesland is optimistic that the teams will ultimately prevail. Quote, you can send a rocket to the moon, he says, and compared to that, it's a piece of cake to drill into the ground. My godfather. From now, scientists and energy companies are mostly pursuing EGS and supercritical geothermal in places where it's relatively easy to reach and reach the temperatures they need, like Iceland, Italy, and American West. But eventually, many hope the technologies will allow geothermal energy to spread. For the right price, EGS could make geothermal energy available across much of the world, even in places with cooler crust. It could be used to extract heat for buildings, says Tesla. A supercritical geothermal could unleash enormous energy reserves in volcanic areas around the world, says Lucini. There's a big potential. Ample supercritical sources in one place could even be enough to power the surrounding countries, says Falcone. There's been talk, for instance, of Iceland supplying power to 16 million homes in the UK. Electricity is transportable, she says. It is now. But could high-powered supercritical projects ever be feasible in all areas, reaching such conditions in places with cooler, thick crust like US Midwest and Eastern Europe will require boring through more than 15 kilometres of crust, 13 kilometres, 3 kilometres deeper than any drill has previously gone. I wouldn't say that we're going to see supercritical geothermal development in Kansas in the near future unless you have some magical way of recording the cost or reducing the cost to really deep drilling. So I think you need some Aunt Kansas get a pair of red shoes and a witch to help you out. But Kolobos never says never. Well, he's a big problem, hasn't he? He's got a big problem, doesn't he? Engineers are exploring novel drilling methods using energy waves, high-pressure fluid jets, or lasers, my god, instead of drill bits. Ah, that's so dumb. He is holding out hope that a breakthrough will make a supercritical geothermal ubiquitous. Maybe a 20-year plan would be supercritical EGS anywhere, he says. Oh, that's it. I like a definite person. He never says never, but he does say maybe. Even if Kaludhus' team doesn't come to pass, dream doesn't come to pass, Potential benefits of supercritical wells would still help geothermal become a major global player, says Pocconi. This is of lasers. In future, may not be far off. Fredrickson team plans to get Raritan well flowing in early 2019, eventually linking it to a nearby power plant to make the first commercial supercritical site in the world. Even if someone beats them to it, says Frolifson, a geothermal revolution is coming. It's not a question of if, but when. So typical, like the end quote. And we'll stop that here.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.